You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Brookings Institution, and we're honored today to be partnering with an organization called Count Every Hero to talk about how veterans can protect our American democracy that we all cherish so much. We have an action-packed hour ahead of ourselves, and I'm not going to take long to introduce the very illustrious panel that will speak to what the project and their Operation Protect Democracy is all about. I think I should simply signal at this stage that it's about a lot more than any particular event last November or January, although certainly the election of 2020 caused a lot of us concern in many ways. But this is about issues about, including civic education, opposition to gerrymandering, ensuring transparent votes. It has a genuinely deep-rooted and very bipartisan set of motivations behind it, as reflected in the makeup of the panel and of the entire steering committee of this great project that we're now working with today. We're going to hear first from General Tony Zinni, one of the most accomplished American military leaders of his generation, who was the head of Central Command at the turn of the century, essentially from the Clinton into the Bush years and just during the immediate prelude to operations in Afghanistan and Iraq. We will then hear from Secretary Sean O'Keefe, who worked in the George H.W. Bush administration at the Pentagon as comptroller and then Secretary of the Navy, also served later in the second, the George W. Bush administration. We will hear as well from former Secretary of the Army, Luis Caldera, who worked in the Clinton administration and is also an Army soldier and veteran himself. And then last but not least, my good friend, Admiral Jim Loy, who was Commandant of the Coast Guard at the time of 9/11, was involved in a lot of the initial responses, the security aftermath of that tragic day, but also setting up much of the new kind of infrastructure for protecting our country at that time, including the Transportation Security Administration. So it's a very bipartisan, very accomplished, credentialed group. And I think having introduced the topic and each of them, I can now simply hand off the baton to my friend General Zinni to tell us more about what this project is about and how it hopes to involve many veterans and many Americans in protecting our democracy. General, over to you.
Thank you, Michael. Well, as Michael said, we originally came together. We were concerned about making sure that our members of the armed forces, that their votes counted, that the processes they had to go through, depending upon each state, were done in a way where it made it user-friendly for them to vote and vote in a timely manner. Of course, since then, we have seen a number of things. Again, as Michael pointed out, number of events that challenged our democracy. We came together in a nonpartisan way. We asked those of us that have served at the highest levels, secretaries of our service, four-star combatant commanders and service chiefs, to really begin to emphasize what it means to support and defend our Constitution. And what we have seen, obviously, is efforts to attack institutions that are set down in our Constitution, democratic processes, especially voting, as again was mentioned. And we want to at least make sure that everyone understands that as former members of the armed service and those that have taken an oath to support and defend the Constitution and see it as a lifelong responsibility, that there's a need to stand up and say that some of the things we've seen go counter to our Constitution, counter to our democracy, and we want to be sure everybody understands what we need to do to be sure that we do not lose our way in all this and that we're clear as to what it means to defend and support the Constitution. Yeah, as Michael mentioned, we broadened this out greatly. We wanted to make sure we stay non-political. That's difficult at times, and I realize that. But that's our charter, to be nonpartisan and non-political in any way. But when we see things like proposed legislation, changing a process, restricting voting ability, gerrymandering, making it more difficult for some members of our community to vote and to be counted, that deeply concerns us. We also are concerned about the education and what it means to be an American and what it means to support and defend that Constitution and the importance of that oath and the depth of understanding we should have. And so part of what we are doing is also emphasizing the need for civics education in our schools to make sure that everyone understands what our Constitution says, what it means, why we hold it dear. And particularly for our members of the armed service, one thing that strikes me is, and motivated me to be part of this is I could not imagine a member of our armed service serving in some country, fighting for someone else's ability to vote and self-determine their future while at home getting mail saying that a family member or a community member or a friend is restricted from voting in some way or finding it more difficult. I mean, that's counter to everything we ask that service member to support and defend. So this has been a collective group that have come together to look at our democratic processes, our democratic institutions, our Constitution, and to ensure that we do not do anything in any way to damage it, and that we make clear what everybody should understand about those processes and those institutions. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to our service secretaries and emphasize one thing before I do that. You see, we deliberately did not just go for those in uniform as leadership. As part of our Constitution, we obviously stress civilian leadership over the military and wanted this to reflect that principle as well. So over to you, Secretary O'Keefe.
Thank you, General Zinni. It's a pleasure to be with you and to all of you this morning, I think, to talk about a very important topic. And Michael, thank you again for your efforts to moderate and host us here to organize this discussion. I'd like to pick up just on a quick theme that I think General Zinni mentioned, F for emphasis. Participation in our democracy isn't just a right. It's a responsibility. It's something we all should share as citizens. Is a responsibility to participate in how the governance of our country is selected, it's chosen, our leaders are organized, and as a consequence, that really requires that we also view it as a responsibility to make that access, to take advantage of, as well as to exercise that responsibility to the very best of our ability to do so, to make that access possible. That's what seems to be at issue here. The debate is going on about whether we should restrict it or not. In the 2020 election, so much of what was demonstrated and then contested in dozens of court challenges, ultimately proved that there was a remarkable level of not only access, but also fairness and security in providing that particular access to exercise our responsibility as citizens to participate. That's a critical feature, and I think it's one that in which every one of those judicial decisions, the determination was overwhelming that it had been sustained, that the security of this particular process worked as well as anything we've ever attempted to do in the past, even though we had record turnout this past year during a very challenging period in our nation's history during the midst of a pandemic. All that converges to really support the propositions the General's enumerated in terms of what has brought us together to exercise our responsibility as a means to assure that access to all citizens to provide the means for that responsibility as well. In this case, we uniquely, as he mentioned, came together to assure that we protect the rights and the responsibility of those serving in uniform, who we ask to be in lots of places around the globe that are not accessible to the standard polling procedures that normally would occur. And so therefore, the opportunity to do so by absentee ballot and any number of different other options or alternatives to exercise that responsibility to vote is an important feature of what brought us together to make that possible. That, in turn, is the element that has become more contested. And this opportunity for access to exercising our responsibility is not a political proposition of why that should be only available for some and not others. Baked into the very foundation of this republic is the proposition that all of us should have that option to do so, and in fact should be expected to participate. I'm going to turn it over to Secretary Caldera for his views as well.
Thank you very much, Sean. Let me add to our discussion. You know, when we took that oath to defend the Constitution, that didn't end when we took off the uniform. We still feel that a desire to serve our country, to defend our country's Constitution. And our Constitution sets up this democratic process that we see at risk, that we see under threat today from a number of different directions that need to be addressed. One is foreign interference in elections. We cannot stand for that. So we need new laws for that. And we need disclosure of where money comes from into campaigns to make sure that foreign money isn't finding its way into our elections. Another is things like cybersecurity and the threats against election administration. So we need to modernize our voting equipment and the training of our election officials. And those officials should be studiously nonpartisan. This is an area where veterans can also help, because we've seen that there is on occasion intimidation against poll workers and things like that. And if there's someone who can stand up to that, it's someone who has worn the uniform. But we also see internal threats to our democracy. We're not bystanders in our democracy. We should be active participants in our democracy. So we shouldn't just leave it to the two political parties to divide up political power or draw the lines of elections or create rules that are more favorable to whatever group happens to be in power that could write the rules on that particular day. I mean, we should note that one third of eligible Americans did not participate in the last election. And we should be concerned about that level of participation and ask, why did they not participate? Was it misinformation, and do we need to address that? Was it the nature of our electoral districts that are non-competitive, and how do we address gerrymandering? And I think part of the history of you know, our country of voting has been toward an expansion of the franchise, toward recognizing the equal political dignity of every individual, regardless of their background, regardless of their wealth, regardless of whether they are a fifth generation American or a first generation American. And that trend line included things like passage of voting rights legislation to make it possible to challenge jurisdictions that were either intentionally or as by the operation of the laws that they had put in place, discriminating against particularly vulnerable populations, African-Americans, language minorities, young people, other kinds of groups. If we don't do that, then we're not recognizing the equal political dignity of every individual. Whether if you're an older homeowner or if you're a young student, in a college dorm, you have equal political dignity, and we should want all Americans to participate into helping to direct our nation's laws. That's where those laws get their legitimacy. That's where what strengthens our democracy. That's the example that we want to set for the world. And I just want to add one last little footnote. You know, it was returning African-American and Mexican-American and other Latino soldiers coming back from World War II and from Vietnam who said, we will not be second-class citizens in our country any longer. They had been used to discrimination, but having gone out, fought, and bled for their country and for the right to vote and to be recognized as full Americans, they came back and created the civil rights organizations, which just stood up for basic decency, basic acknowledgement of their rights, including their right to political participation. We live in an era today where, with supercomputers, people are able to do things like identify what are the ways in which African-Americans participate at higher levels than the electorate at large, and then say, let's cut those off. like voting on Sundays, on the early voting on Sundays and Souls to the Polls movement of taking people from directly from churches to encouraging to go to the polls and vote. There have been instances in this case where lawmakers have said, let's cut that out because that benefits Democrats because it turns out the African-American vote. That kind of toying with electoral rules for partisan advantage is wrong. And that's part of why we need a national law and why we support the national efforts to reinstate preclearance under the John Lewis Act, the national laws to standardize, not all, but some of the basic features of our democracy so that people can have more confidence that everyone has a right to participate equally. And now let me turn it over to my colleague, Admiral Jay Malloy.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, and thanks to all of you for joining us this morning. Michael, I think the three predecessors here have captured many of the points that we wanted to collectively make. So let me zoom in on just one or two that have always rung the bell, so to speak, for me. The first one is civic literacy, the whole notion of having a commitment as a group to make it quite clear to the American public at large that the challenge of the civics course in eighth grade or ninth grade should not be the end game with regard to how we as a nation build the electorate in a fashion that provides an informed group of citizens that can determine the direction and the differences of any policy questions for our country. That whole notion of civics education running not only through that eighth grade course, but all the way through high school and all the way through your college experience. And even as a citizen, self-determining yourself to be an informed citizen so that when it comes time to cast that vote that we're trying so hard to protect, that it is a vote cast with a literate foundation, understanding how the process works, having listened very carefully to candidates tell their stories, and to then vote as an individual citizen of our country. So civic literacy is one of the planks of our program that we're trying to make sure we get across very strongly. And then the second, to go back to what Secretary Caldera just mentioned a moment ago, the whole notion of the United States as a beacon of hope around the world, as a democratic country founded in institutions that were so extraordinarily important as we broke away across the 18th and 19th and into the 20th century, to just recognize that there are right and wrong ways for peoples of the world to work with each other to provide direction provide direction in the well-being of their countries. The United States was that beacon of hope. This is Ronald Reagan's mansion on the hill. This is the whole idea of the Marshall Plan following World War II, where our country has often and rightly been recognized as that beacon of hope to other democratic-seeking citizens of other countries around the world. And the last thing we want to do is have any way of tarnishing that image by some of the theatrics that we have watched over the course of our last couple of years here at home. So, Michael, we as a group have established this set of principles against which we want very much to motivate the thinking of our citizenry to join our citizenry in protecting those basic tenets of the Constitution that we all learned as students, young students, and young Americans. And then as veterans, those of us who have donned the uniform and served, as our three previous folks have mentioned, around the world, providing the support for the notions of what democratic principles are all about. That collective effort is what brought this group together. And as veterans, having taken that oath and having recognized the devotion to duty that taking that oath represents, drives us as a collection to ensure that politics does not weaken that very basic premise to the well-being of our country and our citizenry, not only at home, but around the world.
Thank you all. And let me applaud again the project. And now we're going to go to a lightning round of questions from the audience before I turn things over to my colleague, Elaine Kmark, at the bottom of the hour for panel two. And so if you don't mind, maybe each of you in the same sequence could address one of these questions if you wish. And let me just pose them briefly to you. And thanks to the audience for these questions. One has to do with the nature of our all-volunteer military and whether we should consider some form of mandatory national service that would get more Americans involved in one way or another in serving the country, whether that would contribute to the goals of your project. A second question is about disinformation targeting U.S. veterans. And this relates to some of the other specific questions that come in that have come in about the fact that there were many veterans, sadly, involved in the January 6th insurrection. Is there something we can do to discourage that kind of behavior? Is there something you would want to speak to on that issue? Another question, just very straightforwardly from my colleague, Marvin Kalb, is there a way to depoliticize the military? Or don't you see that as a problem per se, at least not in aggregate terms? And then there are questions about the disenfranchisement movements, as some perceive in the state legislature, movements in recent times, and whether there is something an individual citizen can do to try to weigh in against disenfranchisement. So that's one more very specific question. And then finally, this relates a little bit to the January 6th question from before, but it's about militia movements more generally, including those that have not committed crimes or used violence. But nonetheless, is there a way to maybe direct some of these in a more constructive direction or ask veterans to consider different kinds of associations because we deem the militia movements to be too worrisome as potential threats to our democracy? So that's a lot to throw at you all at once. I hope one or two of them grabbed each of your attention. And now if I could just ask for a 1 to 2 minute response from each of you, starting with General Zinni, please.
Okay, thank you, Michael. Let me talk a little bit about the all-volunteer military. First of all, I think we ought to broaden out a consideration for voluntary service and not just military. I would like to see some sort of national program. I've been on a number of campuses. I've had chairs at 9 different universities, and I'm often approached by young students saying, I want to do something for my country. I've been really impressed with the number I've seen that have done this and or asked me this question. And I just wish we would organize some sort of structure. I mean, the Peace Corps is out there. The military is an option. But I would like to see more emphasis on an all-volunteer national program that gets into every aspect of our society where there is a need and is structured in a way that encourages young people on campuses, be they high school or college, to join. I don't see us going to a draft or conscription military. I don't think it's necessary. I think we're beyond that point at this level. The other thing I would mention very quickly is depoliticizing the military. The military I grew up in was not political. I cannot remember ever talking to another officer about politics. I mean, as a matter of fact, there was sort of an unwritten code, politics and religion were things you did not discuss in a military context. And I don't ever remember it happening. So if there is that tendency now, I think we need to go back and relook as to how our military was structured and the standards we lived up to and how we tried to de-emphasize any kind of politicalization of the military.
Fantastic. Thank you. Secretary O'Keefe.
Yeah, just let me speak to the disenfranchisement of the electorate question. I think that's an important one. And it, again, is partly ascribing intent behind so much of what the state legislative initiative has been about. The reality is what this is I think, a spirited debate, and in some cases an errant debate, over the question of support for legislation that requires a level of transparency that indeed then assures the credibility of that system to our citizens. It says this is a transparent process. There has to be a review and constant oversight of campaign finance enforcement, campaign laws, the risk limiting kinds of audit, which are used around paper ballots and so forth, are all fundamental elements to assure that transparency. In some states, that legislation has been taken to extremes that were intended well beyond that scope. If the objective is, and what we support, we've all debated this among our collective here of the Count Every Hero effort, that we're all about the proposition of transparency and assuring that process has the credibility of citizens who can go to the polls and have a confidence that they are having a vote that counts. That's what matters, and that ought to be the high standard by which this kind of effort to really align a very specific procedure around electoral systems ought to be judged by. And that's what we're debating, I think, in our view of where some states have gone to the point of extremes to work this through for reasons that transcend this question of transparency, have other intentions behind them. That is the point of, I think, of our objection to an awful lot of that.
Thank you, Secretary Caldera.
Now, let me also address the issue of depoliticizing the military and of participation in the military. So first of all, I think we should make the distinction between those who are wearing the uniform and those who have taken the uniform off. Clearly, those who are wearing the uniform act and should act in a nonpartisan, non-political manner. Our nation's defense is too important for it to become a partisan issue. And by and large, the Congress, those who wear the uniform, have operated in that way and tried not to politicize it. We do get in danger when, for example, a president refers to generals as my generals or expects personal loyalty as opposed to loyalty to the Constitution and to defending our country. When you take off the uniform, there are some retired general officers who believe that they should continue to live by the same code and not participate in politics. But there are many others who said, wait a minute, I'm an American. I defended this country. I cherish my liberties as an American. And that includes the right to participate politically, the right to free speech, the right to express my opinions about what I think is best for this country, including political participation. And so we see that. We see individuals of all ranks endorsing and supporting various candidates. One of the reasons we came together was this idea of trying to make sure that every service member has the opportunity to vote, because states have very different laws in terms of by when your absentee ballot must arrive. For some states, it's before election date. For others, it's as long as 2 and 3 weeks after the election. But soldiers who are deployed, who are on submarines, who are on field exercises, often can't meet the deadlines of requesting the ballot, getting the ballot, voting the ballot, mailing it, and getting it in on time. So that we were really focused on that issue. But one of the things that it illustrates is that in America, we have the right to vote. We have lots of barriers to voting. We have little encouragement to vote. That is, government doesn't work either to lower those barriers or to encourage active participation. And I think we need to do more on the active participation part, respecting individuals' right to vote. That is, don't tell a soldier how to vote, but tell them, you know, it's your duty as an American to participate and vote. And I encourage you to vote, not just, hey, the absentee ballot form is available if you want to vote. And that I think that goes throughout our country, that we ought to do more to encourage participation in our democratic process.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. And Admiral Loy, over to you for the last word on panel one.
Thank you very much, Michael. I, too, I think would reinforce this. One of the questions that you posed was the idea of disinformation targeting veterans. So part of the reason Count Every Hero was pulled together was to offer the counter to that. In other words, to whatever degree there is an observed disinformation campaign in whatever level, at the state level, at the city level, or let alone at the federal level, that targets veterans. We wanted to be voices of veterans from the past and the current and today that is providing the veteran the right information that he or she needs in order to be the citizen that Secretary Caldera just described. That citizen anxious to participate in the process of defining the future of their country, and that's what the vote is all about. So the effort that Caliber Hero is pushing so strongly is to be, first of all, very straightforward with only a handful of principles, five or six principles that we can talk to in whatever fora we get the opportunity to speak about it, including, Michael, the panel you're offering us here this morning, so that the veteran community listening can recognize the legitimacy and the rightness of their responsibilities to cast that vote, to take care of timeliness with regard to whatever the rules are that are governing that voting process for themselves, but to also be recognized as a veteran and as a citizen. Your responsibility to cast that vote remains your opportunity to participate in the greatest democracy that was ever put on the face of the earth.
Let me thank you all very, very much, as well as the organization that you represent and the many other veterans who are working with you and all Americans who are working to strengthen our democracy. And with that, I'm just going to seamlessly hand off now to Elaine Kmark, who will lead a discussion with panel two and some other Americans committed to this same general mission. Thank you and best wishes. And Elaine, over to you, my friend.
Thank you. Well, thank you, everyone, and good morning, everyone. In the interest of time, I'll give some very brief, a brief introduction of our distinguished panelists and have them pass off from one to the other, just as Michael did. We're going to start, we're just going to do this alphabetically. We're going to start with Jeremy Butler. Jeremy is the CEO of the Iraq-Afghan Veterans of America, a terrific organization, which I was happy to be part of the founding some years ago. I'm a mother of a Navy veteran and a mother-in-law of a Navy veteran and an active duty Army officer. So I've watched that group and how it's grown and all the good stuff it's done. Jake, Jeremy, if you'll hand off to Jake Harrison. Jake is the founder of A More Perfect Union, which is geared to has the almost impossible task of trying to make our politics and our nation more civil to each other and more less confrontational and get rid of some of the ugliness out there. And I can't wait to hear what you have to say, Jake, on this topic. And Jake, I'll ask you to please pass it off to Susan Thaxton, who is the Chief Program Officer of the Mission Continues, a group that I know a great deal about from the Joe Klein's wonderful book, Charlie Mike, all about it. And I have watched that for years and years through hurricanes and various deployments all over the world and in the United States. So with that, the title of this panel is The Role of Veteran Services Organizations in Promoting and Protecting Democracy. And Jeremy, let's start with you for a couple minutes and we'll just go right through the three people and hopefully then have a little time for questions.
Excellent. Thank you. I appreciate it. I'll try to just throw out a few things and get things going, but I appreciated the previous panel and I'll kind of add on to a few things like that. So IAVA, you know, a big focus of ours has always been on advocacy, talking nationally and to Congress about things that we feel need to be changed and improved for the veteran community. And the basis of that has always been nonpartisanship. If we want to get things done for the veterans community, we need to work with both the right, the left, and the center if we're going to do that. And that carries over to the work that we've been doing around voting, and expansion of democracy. It really started, I shouldn't say it really started, but it really ramped up maybe in two election cycles ago with the presidential campaign, when we really pushed for a forum with the leading candidates to talk about issues, foreign policy issues that were really affecting the veteran community. Again, it was the desire to get both sides talking, hear from both sides, not to support one or the other, but to really get veterans learning and hearing and speaking about issues on both sides. In this last campaign, it was really about the get out the vote. It was an understanding that it was going to be a challenging environment for voting because of the pandemic. So that spread to not only just raising awareness of the issues, but also raising awareness around the need to get more poll workers out there. There was going to expected to be a shortage of poll workers because of the fact that it was usually the older generation that was working at election sites. And so we wanted to help get that out. We wanted to make sure that there was truth and honesty out there about how people can register to vote, where they can register to vote. So we started our own program. Many others did the same thing, but it was really just a very straightforward website and messaging campaign around make sure that you're getting registered, make sure that you know how to vote, make sure that you know all your options to vote, mail-in voting and things like that. And that really took off given all of the misinformation and the pushback that was kind of happening throughout there during the campaign. And that really continues to today. And I think we continue with the post-January 6th situation to understand that we need to continue to make sure that there's transparency and smart conversations happening that aren't partisan in nature. And so we're just trying to help lead on that effort and point people in the right direction and raise conversations and host conversations and be a part of conversations like this, where we're really making sure that veteran voices are heard and that they are receiving fact-based information so that they can make their own right decisions as they want. And with that, I'll pass it over to Jake, please.
Thanks, Jeremy. I got to say, it's really humbling to be a part of this panel today. Thank you very much for the opportunity. More Perfect Union came out of my experiences coming back from overseas. So I was a Marine, first with infantry and then a group called Force Recon after that, a few tours of combat in Iraq and some other places. And really out there fighting, like all of us did, violent extremism to kind of help protect and preserve the idea of America, thinking that our nation's greatest enemy was downrange. I remember coming back, moving back to the U.S. Permanently in 2015. I've been deployed and I've been overseas for almost 15 years at that point. Now, I remember coming home and not recognizing the country that I came home to, not recognizing the country that I left to fight for in 2000. The country was just bitterly divided by this fear and divisiveness. There were these two political parties had formed a harmful duopoly that was just destroying all value for the American citizen. And the American people had no more voice. And I just found myself really despondent. I was very sad. You know, I mean, all of us had been downrange fighting and sacrificing so much to protect and preserve this idea, thinking that our enemy was downrange, only to realize that it wasn't going to be violent extremism overseas that defeated our democracy. It was going to be political extremism here at home that was going to defeat us. It was going to be us. So then I got really angry and I thought, well, we as veterans, we have something we can contribute. You know, we're always about taking the next hill. We're always about finding that next purpose and drive in that next mission. And I know that Susan's going to talk a lot about that in the group she works with the Mission Continues. But what we decided to do in building More Perfect Union, we just thought, you know, our democracy is in a really dangerous place right now, as we just heard on the last panel. And we need to be thinking big right now. We need to be taking big, bold risks. So at More Perfect Union, we put together a 10-plus-year strategy to try to accomplish two massive goals. One is to help try to heal the divide in the country that's tearing us apart. And the other one is to build a center in American politics that helps make the government more functional again for the people. So on the movement side to help heal, we want to build a veteran-led movement that will be the next generation of civic organization for the country. So think Rotary Club, Lions Club, Kiwanis Club. Those are all sadly in decline. Our civic fabric is eroding. We need a new generation, a next generation civic organization to get behind, to get our next generation of folks involved in, to really have sweat equity and ownership in our democracy. And that's what this next More Perfect Union chapters will be all over the country. Veterans will be used to lead, found, and convene folks from the left and right to form these chapters. And the reason, you know, why veterans? because veterans consistently poll 70% plus for trust in the country. When you look at our institutions, veterans and military are the kind of the last trusted institution in the country versus Congress, which on the last poll was like 11%. So we want to use veterans as the convening force. As folks come together in these chapters, the whole focus is community service projects. Average ordinary American citizens are going to be coming together to make their communities better together, breaking bread together, getting their hands dirty together, and being able to have tough conversations about what unites us, about the things that unite us are so much more important sometimes than the things that divide us. And the second thing that we're doing is we are trying to build this center out in politics. We're attempting to get 3 to 5 country first candidates elected into the U.S. Senate to form a powerful fulcrum in the Senate. These folks will run as Republicans, Democrats. Most of them are former special operations combat veterans that are now running companies and funds and firms that are doing one more 6-year tour, this time in the Senate, to help defend our democracy. And the goal of that group, the very first legislation that they want to move through the Senate, will be a federal reform bill that helps reform our political system and make our democracy stronger. Many of the things that we just heard from General Zinni and Secretaries O'Keefe and Caldera and Admiral Lloyd. So this federal reform bill is important. We have to see some critical changes in our political system if we are going to be able to get everyone to have that equal right and chance and opportunity to cast their vote. I'm a big believer in what they're doing. So with that, I will pass it on to Susan at The Mission Continues.
Great. Thanks, Jake. And like Jake, I am really humbled to be a part of this conversation today and to have the work of The Mission Continues recognized to be part of this conversation. So thank you so much for having us today. Just to tell you a little bit about The Mission Continues, we are a national nonprofit and we empower veterans to continue their service by applying both their leadership skills and their experience to volunteer in under-resourced communities. So we do this by having groups of volunteers. We call them service platoons. They are both veterans and non-veterans, but led by veterans that are partnering with community organizations and community leaders in 40 under-resourced communities across this country. We also provide leadership development programs for our veteran leaders who go to do this to give them not only the skills to be able to do this, but the mindset as well, so that they are equipped to appropriately go into these communities, to approach, to establish these relationships, to understand the community and how our veterans and how our volunteers can meaningfully be a part of addressing challenges in those communities. We know that when veterans leave the service, they don't leave necessarily what drove them to the service in the first place. They don't leave that desire to have a bigger purpose, to have a mission, to connect with people, to work together with people, to do something bigger than themselves. And when they take off the uniform, they don't get rid of all of that. They definitely still have all of that. And without an opportunity to tap in, to continue to connect, to continue to serve, to continue to have that purpose, they can be lost. They can go in lots of different directions. And we have a place for them. And we tap into that because our country needs them. We definitely have challenges inside this country right now, all over this country. And our service platoons are out there working in partnership with those communities to help address some of those challenges. I think that we don't tackle politics head on by any means, but organically what comes out of our work, I think is what's really important is in this context, is that this it reduces that otherness that we are seeing so much in this country right now and so much of that division, that when we bring veterans together in these communities and veterans with non-veterans as volunteers, and they get to be exposed to people that maybe they wouldn't know in any other context. They get to be exposed even to other veterans who they don't have that regular daily life with and regular in that same perspective. And then to go into communities maybe that they've never been in before, that maybe they've drawn a lot of assumptions about who lives there and what they do, and actually get in and see that and talk to people and meet people and get a better understanding of what the issues are and the complexity around these issues. And instead of looking for a tribe that you're united by what you're not and by what the others are, we unite people by understanding what we all are working towards, what we all want for ourselves, what we want for this country. And volunteerism is such an important part of having a healthy civil society. I think what we have also seen in this past year, the previous panel was talking about faith in institutions and how at the very local level, How veterans can be called on to be that stabilizing, to help the stabilizing force in issues where things can get very destabilized. And we saw, like, during COVID, the food insecurity that was such an issue, and ourselves and other veteran organizations were out in communities tackling food distribution, trying to work with food pantries and others to try to address this very immediate, very significant problem in our country that can really destabilize a community and create a lot of anger and frustration. The veteran community came together through the Vaccine Coalition of Veterans to help with vaccine distribution when we started initially distributing the vaccines across the country. Veteran organizations are getting involved right now as to how to address the resettlement logistics for our Afghani refugees. So to call on these different veteran organizations to come together to kind of help provide some different and additional capacity to these institutions that are trying to do this, and the importance that that creates for our communities at the very local level, I think is really important as well.
Well, that's wonderful. And thank you. Thank all of you for your comments and for what you're doing here and what you're doing. So let me just say, I'm going to go as Michael did. I'm going to give a couple, I'm going to lay out the questions, and then we'll just go around in the same order, and you can address any of them or none of them as you see fit. Jeremy, I do want to say, and this is, I think, particularly useful to all the groups here, getting veterans to be poll watchers is a big deal. We're going to face a lot of disruption at polls in the coming years, and the usual group that were poll watchers are frankly little old ladies. And I am a little old lady, but I will tell you that there's two problems with little old ladies. A, they're not very tough, and B, they don't have the computer skills that are needed for some of the new technology in voting. So we really do need to have a whole new generation of poll watchers before the next elections. And I think anything you all can do on that front would be just terrific. Let me just go through the questions that have come in, and then we'll take them in the order that you spoke. Margaret from the U.S. Military Academy says that 25% of those at the insurrection on January 6th had some affiliation with the military. What can be done in the responsible discourse with the public to deal with that issue? Greg asked to comment on the disinformation that is targeting U.S. veterans and the approaches to protecting our veterans from disinformation attacks. Zachariah asked about, does anybody on the panel support mandatory national service? And if so, what would it look like? And finally, Phil asks, how can we expect meaningful upgrades to election laws when every state has the right to enact their own laws? That one is a simple one that I can answer, which is the John Lewis bill, which is pending in Congress right now, pending in the House, but not likely to pass in the Senate, would in fact supersede state laws in many instances and establish a process for preclearance, which we used to have, so that some states that had a history of bad behavior in terms of voter suppression would have to be pre-cleared for their voting procedures. So we can do that, even though Phil, you are correct that most of this is most of the laws are state laws. And by the way, the Jake, your depth in the community, Susan, your depth in the communities are very important, because it's not just the laws, it's the actual implementation of those laws, which you can't see nationally all the time. You really do need people. You need boots on the ground in the election system. So with my two cents done, Jeremy, why don't you start and we'll pass it around.
Great. And I'll try and be brief so everyone has some time. I'll kind of just two of them. I feel like there's mandatory national service, and then I feel like to a certain extent, the other three questions kind of overlap. I do support something along the lines of national service, maybe not with the word mandatory in there, but maybe with highly encouraged. And as the previous panel discussed, you know, really making it clear that that encompasses a broad range of service, everything from the military to the Peace Corps, to the mission continues, more perfect union. There's so many different ways that volunteering and national service broadens your horizons. It did it for me, and it continues to do so for me. And so the more that we can encourage it, I think the better off our country will be, because people will just learn so much from it. And then to the other questions, which I am kind of rolling up into one, you know, I think misinformation, disinformation is so much of the problem, and that includes the discussion around the election laws and things like that. There's a lot of talking points that, you know, people are saying we've lost trust in our electoral system. But I think that's because of the lies that have been spread. I don't think the system itself is a major issue here. There's certainly things that can be improved and should be improved. And I'll tie it together with the original comment around working as a poll worker. I volunteered as a poll worker for the first time in the presidential election, and then again, just in the primary. And nothing made me more confident in our electoral process than seeing behind the scenes how it works. It was a great opportunity, and I do encourage everyone to do it. Not only did I get a chance to meet a whole bunch of my neighbors that I'd never met before, but it really did make me more confident in the process. And so I'll stop with that. I could keep going, but I know time is short.
And I think that's great, Jeremy. And just build on kind of what you're saying there, I'd like to address kind of this challenge of the misinformation, disinformation targeting veterans, the 25% associated with veterans that were at the insurrection. I think there are a few things we can do to combat this. Number one, you know, Elaine, you said this yourself, we need to be in the communities. Too many leaders like to talk, they like to write op-eds, they like to go on the news and try to dictate to Americans about their own lives without actually being on the ground in the communities. We need a whole new generation of servant leaders who are out there in the communities, listening with a humble attitude to the challenges that Americans are facing every single day and responding to those needs real time. So number one, I think we got to be in the communities. Number two, we are facing a crisis of leadership in this country. We need a new, I mentioned it before, we need a new type of leader to step forward in this next generation. And it's got to be, these leaders have got to be servant leaders, individuals who are willing to put the needs of themselves last, you know, put the needs of their people first, put the needs of the country ahead of party, put the needs of their people ahead of their own needs, those kinds of things. And what we see today is we see political leaders that thrive off partisanship. They thrive off the division that actually gives them more influence, more power, more fame. And so they don't try to heal the divide. They try to deepen it because that actually gives them more authority, more power, and more influence. But what we see across the country are Americans looking for leadership, and especially veterans looking for leadership, and they follow those leaders. They listen to what they say, and they respond accordingly. So we need a new type of generation of leaders to say enough, and with the attitude of we're going to serve the country and not ourselves. And the final thing I would say is, you know, I think veterans, and we've talked about this before, veterans want and desire and thrive off of purpose, right? So if in absent of that, in a vacuum, they're going to find something to go after and get behind, right? What you see a lot of these folks that joined the insurrection, many of them think that they're fighting the next cause to save our democracy, right? Because their leaders are leading them down the wrong road, right? But we need to channel all that energy into a new productive, positive purpose at the community level. And I think a lot of the work that great groups like the Mission Continues and IAVA and More Perfect Union, what the work we're doing at the community level gives an outlet and a channel for veteran leaders to be able to find that purpose and be able to use that kind of that mission-driven desire to take the next hill. And that next hill being helping save our democracy.
Yes, and I, you know, just to add on that, I agree that things at the local level and seeing at the local level, and rather than it just being what people are finding on social media, right, and what's just being blasted out there, and having a chance for veterans to be able to be in local communities and actually seeing what the reality is and what the issues really are. The you know, in the previous panel, they talked about disenfranchisement. And this goes back to what Jake said, too, is when veterans are feeling completely disconnected, when they feel like people don't understand them, when they feel like people see them as some sort of other because it's an experience and something that they just don't understand, where are they going to go? And so I think it's really important that our organizations continue pushing forward to engage them, to bring them in, to say, you come here because here's your purpose. Here's your mission. And this is where you can serve and really have an impact. And I think it's important for local communities to recognize that as well, to find, you know, what are the veteran organizations that are around, and understanding all that veterans can bring into a community and the positive impact that can have on that community, and engage them and understand that they can really help move all of this forward. Would be my tip beyond the veteran community, is to recognize the assets that they really are.
Well, everyone did a marvelous job of actually ending us at exactly when we are supposed to end. I want to thank Jeremy, Jake, and Susan. I want to thank you for your participation, but also for the great work all of you are doing, both at home in our own communities and around the world. And I think there's a lot more work ahead of us, but I also think that if anybody can do it, you guys can. So thank you very much. Thank you to Mike and the previous panel for organizing this session.